Hey folks, we're back. State Representative Tacky Chan and me for our Tacky Talk podcasts. Tacky, welcome back.
Hey, good to see you, Joe. Actually, our first podcast of October, if I calculated correctly.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's been 3 weeks. I just haven't known what to do with myself.
Yeah, unfortunately, our schedules didn't quite hook up properly. This will happen every so often, and but it creates more opportunity to talk about all kinds of world events over the last few weeks.
Yes, I've been inundated with, cards and letters and emails saying, where's Tacky? Not really.
I didn't think anyone cared that much to know where I've been or not been. Although I heard one of my friends, the sound of my voice puts her to sleep. So maybe just, I stopped some insomnia situation for some individual out there hoping for a soothing, quiet voice to go to sleep to.
Hey, we all have our talents. So, well, it's nice to know that she listens at least.
I don't know if she's going to listen again. She was driving. So.
Ah, okay. Well, we don't want her to fall asleep then, that's for sure. No.
But fall is here. Fall is here.
Yeah, fall is here and we're in like full-blown election mode too.
Massachusetts is not a swing state, obviously. So we don't feel the same pressure as like the other 11 odd states right now, which is getting a whole lot of attention. And I like to remind folks that we do get this question every so often: how come we can't be a swing state? For those who may remember, go back to the Martha Coakley Scott Brown U.S. Senate race special election in 2010 January, where we were swing state behavior, where you got more phone calls, more mail, more TV ads, more radio ads than you could ever want to live with.
Yes, I remember all too well.
Yeah, it was neck high in that campaign. So, every so often someone asks me, well, we should be a swing state. We want attention. I'm like, you've forgotten how bad it was when we got attention. It was just annoying people to no end because I was
Yeah.
more complaints about it than actual benefit of turning out voters.
Although interestingly, the Senate race this year is getting some attention for sure.
Yeah, I didn't watch the debate. I did watch the summary in the Globe from the various columnists, and not surprising, in the Republican playbook on a national level, not the local level, but a national level, is really revolving around immigration, and it's the playbook they decided to run with. The Democratic playbook on a national level, not the state or local level, continues to be focusing on big issues that affect everyday people, such as inflation, wages, healthcare, housing, just really pinpoint stuff that affects every family, and try to frame the argument against Republicans back to that bipartisan immigration bill that failed in the Senate. But interestingly enough, this Warren and I think Ed Markey both voted against that
That's
immigration bill,
correct. Yes.
which is kind of a quirky argument to make from her standpoint. But the idea of a bipartisan effort to address a major political hot button issue that could not have been addressed because a certain Republican candidate for president decided that he wanted to make it a front and center issue, as opposed to, I don't know, we can work together issue, has now shifted it. And as we were joke talking earlier, only half jokingly, about the Martha Coakley Scott Brown race, we do have short memories in politics. We really do, unless you're like me, who like track this stuff, and people like you who in the media, who have need to know these long memories and timelines. Many regular people do not have the bandwidth to remember all this stuff on top of their regular lives, so things that are much more important, to be honest with you. I mean,
Right.
you all have jobs and kids and family and real priorities in your day-to-day life. And I don't expect people to remember the two of us bringing up ancient history these days on politics and history and socioeconomics and how times change and how we observe the change. And that's kind of one of the battles of the last few months and going to the final days for particularly national candidates to kind of drill home the fact that, this did happen, right? And whether you believe it or not, well, you can look it up yourself and use articles. But
It's been 12 years, right? Yeah, 12 years. Yeah.
yeah. So it's kind of one of those things that people need to, I mean, you take it at face value, or can look at on news articles or whatever you want to
Right.
there. But
Yeah,
it's
but I mean, today's 18-year-olds who are voting for the first time were six. So,
But this is every 4-year cycle, right? We talk about
Yeah.
this all the time, about this youth vote, whatever generation designation. And what does that youth vote want in order to be motivated by it? I mean, during Obama's first campaign, that youth vote was real.
Absolutely.
During the Clinton campaign, the first Clinton campaign, Bill Clinton, not Hillary, that vote was real. Rock the vote was a real thing. I remember that a lot of young people turned out to vote for Bill Clinton. They made a strong effort. Well, who they turn out for this time? Well, you never know until the vote's cast.
Right. Yeah. It's, and it's so different now. But, there was no social media then. There was no early voting. There was no mail-in voting. So it was it, that truly was grassroots. Today it's just it's widespread.
Yeah, so you got a lot of first-time voters that lived through three very different types of presidential elections. Three very different economic environments, a once in a lifetime or 100 years global crisis in COVID, and now voting for the first time. And it will be interesting to see how the different candidates appeal to this very new set of voters.
Yeah, can we talk a little bit about the here in Massachusetts, the ballot questions again? I mean,
Again, we've done this like nine times.
I know, but now people are finally paying attention.
All righty, where's my book? Apparently, not everybody got the book. All right, so some of you, oops, I just dropped a whole lot of stuff behind the computer getting the book.
Oh, get that
But
later.
some of you may have gotten the Massachusetts information book here, which is obviously in verse on YouTube and the video. But you also can get this online at MASS. I dropped it, of course. MASS.gov/SEC. That's the secretary website. Also, you can vote. Also, go to the website voteinma.com. VoteInMA.com. VoteInMA.com, which is the centralized website for the Secretary of State for everything from voter registration to checking your registration to getting a mail-in ballot to checking the ballot questions to find out who the candidates are going to be on your ballot. As we know, early voting has already started by mail-in ballot. You can also check with City Hall or Town Hall if you're not in Quincy to find out when you can come in and vote in person in advance. And if you have those of us who are out of state or in a medical condition, you can get an absentee ballot. So if you're a student, for example, outside Massachusetts, you can still get an absentee ballot if you want. I don't know if students watching me right now, but if you have a family member that's out of state that has residency in Massachusetts but is temporary out of state for work or school, but still is a permanent Massachusetts resident because you spend more than half your time in Massachusetts, you can get an absentee ballot. There's slightly different rules because of that, but the mail-in ballots and so forth, are readily available. And we have five ballot questions that are in the booklet. So how do you want to tackle this, Joe?
I want to talk specifically about ballot question number two, dealing with the MCAS exam.
Yeah, this is a complicated issue. I think it's kind of oversimplified. So the summary of it is that it would eliminate the MCAS requirement for the purposes of high school graduation. It would change the metric for determining high school graduation, not to be the MCAS passage itself. And the argument is that it hurts people that aren't good at standardized testing, people don't speak English as a first language, adversely affects socioeconomic groups. Particularly those in poor areas, and that it puts a lot of pressure on kids to try to pass one exam to get the diploma, as well as our school system, frankly, teaching towards a test. The MCAS is not just basic reading and writing. It is a litany of issues in the schools, which supplants potential options for school. For example, Asian history is not, history of Asia countries are not part of the MCAS. So as a result, why would you ever take a class on Asian history countries or a country, let's say pick China, for example, for sake of ease? Why would you take a study class on modern China or create a class on modern China if it doesn't appear in the MCAS? So it creates an interesting situation where you actually not like college. College, poor preparation for students going to college because students in high school are targeted towards an exam. As a result, when they get to places where they have electives, it changes how you think when you go into college. Now, we have many generations of kids now that actually have gone to the MCAS. I am not one of them. I am pre-MCAS. And I have talked to some colleagues who are much younger than I am, who have taken MCAS. And it's an interesting conversation, depending who you are on the opinion on the matter. Now, why is it kind of a confusing issue? Because just because you can't pass the MCAS doesn't mean you can't graduate high school.
Ah, so this I've not heard before.
There are special conditions, which I don't even fully understand, which allows some flexibility in the Department of Education or school systems to let you take the MCAS a second time, I believe. You can
Yes,
correct
that's right.
me wrong,
Yeah.
as well as taking, individual students' concerns or different developmental issues regarding how they
Yeah.
are.
Yeah, you take it in the 10th grade first, but then you can't take it again in the 11th if you don't pass it.
That's correct. Also, not all schools do the MCAS, which is a little bit peculiar, right? You got private schools, but you also have the charter schools.
Yep.
So there's a bit of inequity regarding private institution and publicly paid for charter schools. Let me make that very clear,
Yes.
publicly paid for.
Good. Yeah, good distinction. Yep.
That are supported by your tax dollars. They're not subject to exactly the same requirements of MCAS. So what does this do? I'm not entirely clear what will happen if we eliminate MCAS requirement, because there's also this larger picture regarding the federal government and No Child Left Behind. Massachusetts ed reform in 1994 was ahead of the curve on a national level regarding supporting inequitable school systems, meaning school districts that aren't provided equal resources, which is why we have Chapter 70, as well as the state providing their school breakfast and school lunches, which we voted for the last two sessions, as well as things like school transportation and special education, all these other funded programs by the state. We've always been ahead of the curve on the federal government in this type of stuff. But there's also this question about how elimination MCAT score would fit into the national No Child Left Behind model created under George H. Bush, if I remember correctly. So, but it really was implemented under Bill Clinton because of, things don't happen overnight, folks.
That's right. Yep.
Multiple administrations in the presidential level actually has to pick up the previous presidential projects and laws and policies, because once the ball rolls, you can't really just stop the ball rolling.
Right.
So that's kind of my general understanding is. I could be wrong on some of these things. Obviously, this is very divisive. A lot of different educators and parents and students all have very different opinions. But I will tell you one thing I find intriguing is the people supporting the MCAS that's paying for it is the business community.
Yes, I noticed that also, and that confused me.
It is troubling because
Yeah.
one of the challenges you see on a national level is the privatization of education. I actually have met an individual who was trying to basically eliminate classrooms in exchange for virtual classrooms before COVID. This was before COVID, paid by basically the Walmart people. And they are known to basically eliminate the concept of public education. And education is the great equalizer among all people to be able to move ahead in life. Because at one time, as you may or may not know, education can only be given those who can afford it.
Right. Yeah.
So that is actually a very curious issue. On the other side, of course, is the Mass Teacher Association, which is the teachers' union. My understanding, even among teachers, again, there's mixed reactions about this. My personal opinion is that you should be able to read, you should be able to write, you should be able to do math. All the other stuff to me is completely extraneous.
Interesting. Yes, I like you am pre-MCAS, but I do recall there were the SATs and the PSATs, right?
Well, I was terrible at that stuff, actually. I'm not
Yeah.
good at it. I was terrible at the SAT. I was terrible at the LSAT. I was not great on the bar exam sampling questions, which I
Yeah.
spent 4 months basically killing myself to get that bar exam done. So I don't think I'm brilliant, but I mean, I would fail the MCAS. I mean, there's no way. I mean, the entire MCAS, I've looked at MCAS questions in the past. You can look it up yourself if you don't believe me. The Globe is a ton of them floating online to pass MCAS. And if you as an adult and me as an adult can't figure this stuff out, then why is it there? Last time
Interesting.
I checked, we all graduated high school, we got through college. I think we're fairly intelligent folks, not an educator.
Well, we have life experience behind us now.
We're old, Joe. We're just
That's
telling you.
I like my description better.
Well, I'm one of those people that believe what's good for the goose is good for the gander, right?
Yeah.
So if you can pass the MCAS yourself and you like this idea, show me you can pass the MCAS.
Right.
Don't give me this lip that, I got a PhD in education. I know better. You do it.
Yeah.
And show me
Well,
that you can are equivalent education requirement of today's high schoolers.
yeah. Well, that leads to the teacher's argument that they have to teach to the test.
Oh, they are. There's no way. I mean, why would you, in your right mind, ever take classes outside of an exam that's essential for your graduation?
Right. That's
Right.
the one goal in high school, right? Is to graduate.
Well, I'll tell you, in law school, me and my buddy Sandy went to law school together. She flat out said to me one day, it's like we were doing course selection. She's like, we work all day, we school all night, we don't have the advantage of some other students and be able to afford more bar prep classes and other types
Yeah.
of student education on exams. So why are we taking classes outside of the bar exam in school when we're trying to equalize the fact that we can't afford and we don't have time to get special assistance outside on how to take a standardized test?
Yeah. This, but as you're aware, this has gotten very political. The governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, speaker of the House have all come out against this.
Yeah, with all due respect, guys, go take the MCAS yourself. All due respect.
Yeah.
Like I said, I've looked at questions. I scratch my head like I don't know how to do this, and why is it here?
Yeah. And I think one of the misconceptions is it's not getting rid of the test. The test doesn't go away. It's just the requirement to pass it to graduate.
That's correct. I mean, the MCAS is still a metric system. The MCAS also has some weird side effects. So, like, your property values are sometimes tied to MCAS because a higher school MCAS rating may result in people want to move to that neighborhood more or
Yes,
school district or
that's
community.
true. Yep.
So it creates additional pressure for school districts to try to keep up with it. I mean, in law school, New England School of Law's big obsession was bar passage rate, right? If you have a high bar passage rate in law school, you entice more people want to come to law school because they believe that the education improves your chances of passing the bar exam. I have mixed opinions about that, if that's true or not, because of the fact you can pay out of pocket for things like barbary and what's the other one? MBRE and other prep classes. Today, you also can pay for things like Kumon, right? And
Yeah.
private tutors. And that can give you a leg of an education. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But to say that education is socioeconomic equitable is to being disingenuous. Right? Those of us who have more means, I was not a family of means. There was no, we couldn't pay for summer school. We couldn't, we no way we're gonna buy a tutor, right? But if you're able to, put the dollars together, it gives you a strategic advantage against the test.
Yeah. Interestingly, just this past week, a case came up down in Hingham regarding artificial intelligence. If you're familiar with this,
No,
okay.
like, tell me about it.
Yes, student at Hingham High School was penalized, disciplined for using artificial intelligence on a class paper. The family's suing the school district, claiming that there was no written policy and that their student did not use AI to write the paper just as a research tool.
Okay, I'm not sure how to answer that question or have a commentary
Yeah,
because
well, the question is does there need to be a statewide policy in public schools regarding AI?
I don't know. Remember the days where people were using Wikipedia as a reference point, right? Well, it was
Yes.
more primitive come to AI. Using the internet was a big part of it, and whether or not you could cite your sources correctly on your documentation on your papers was kind of essential. If you're using AI for research purposes, shouldn't you be able to put footnotes in? Again, I don't know what grade this is. Is it high school, I presume?
High school, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, footnoting was a thing that was taught in actually middle school,
Yep.
and crucial in high school, in college, most definitely, and absolutely in law school. So, I mean, did this kid not know how to use footnotes?
Yeah, that I don't know. But the argument is that there is no written policy in the school handbook, So
Is
that
Footnotes part of the MCAS people? Just is Footnotes part of the MCAS test? I think
Well, is okay, here's a bigger question then. Is artificial intelligence a legitimate reference, resource? Is it valid?
the way I well this I don't know how they teach footnotes anymore. Okay, so
Yeah.
the two old guys are going to talk about footnotes, right? The point of using a reference is that you're able to cite the reference that the person reviewing your documentation is able to find said reference.
Right.
So we're old enough to use encyclopedias, folks. You open
That's
your book,
right.
sir, and spend 25 cents to quote a
Edition
reference.
and page number.
Edition and page number, of which the encyclopedia itself has a reference of where they got its information from. But for the purposes of our education, it was sufficient to cite the encyclopedia itself, even though you didn't have to go to the encyclopedia's own footnotes.
That's right. No, it was assumed the encyclopedia was correct. Yeah.
That's correct. So if you use AI, what is the reference, right?
That's a great question. That's what I'm wondering, right?
And that's the trouble. If I say AI generated, wonderful, but what does that mean? Because then, like an encyclopedia, which can actually you rely as a first source because you rely that the footnotes and research is correct in the massive supplemental section of an encyclopedia, AI doesn't accomplish the same thing.
Right.
So, I was half joking about Wikipedia, but people like myself have used Wikipedia, then go to the links in the bottom, click said link
To verify it,
source
yeah.
to verify these links and whether it was a legit news media article or a somebody blogging,
Right.
somehow got into it. It's like the news feeds. Have you seen how many non-real news media outlets have made into news feeds?
It's very scary.
It's
Yeah,
very scary.
very
When
troubling.
well, very troubling. I've read some of these things on news feeds and cited as sources. I'm like, this isn't a newspaper. This isn't even journalism. This is trash.
Exactly, yeah, and that scares me.
Scares me too.
Yeah.
So if I'm using AI, the point is that I should use AI as a reference. Then proceed to go to the actual reference source, then proceed to actually cite. And I didn't know how to use website-based citations until I got to law school. We had to like do a whole link, and then you had to date it, and you had to cite it. They had to put the whole link down, and they eat up a chunk of the bottom of the page because the links are so long. So I again, I don't know the details of this, but right off the bat, did they ever teach people how to use references correctly in their papers?
I thought the same thing when I heard about this story. Exactly. Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah. Again, half joking. Do they teach footnotes in MCAS? So, this is kind of a failure of the education system at some level. And also the fact that apparently there's a generation of folks that don't know how to use HTML based citations in their reports. I don't know what to say.
I just bring it up just because it's timely and it's interesting and it's new and different, Jackie.
It is different, but as you can tell, the solution isn't complicated.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was rather like you should really reevaluate your teaching methods rather than just like jump to conclusions. And if you want to talk about AI generated work, you could probably duplicate it because the AI only has so many ways it can do so many things. I know it's like infinite, but it really isn't. Where you say, write me a paper in Charlotte's Web, for example, just pick random, or generate something. And if you try to do it yourself and it's simply similar to the paper that's been submitted to you, the question mark becomes, is it really that paper or is it something you just plagiarize essentially? And that's the bigger challenge here, right? And there's no guarantee that AI does not plagiarize.
That's true too. Yeah, we don't know where it came from. That's right.
Yeah, unless the AI actually generates all the reference points and footnotes and forms a final page in the back on references, is or is not a certain say words or phrases, well, actually not phrases. I mean the whole paragraph is from another person's paper, which is another whole other question about AI down the road regarding validity of copyright works and licensing, which is a whole different issue. So it is intriguing. Again, I don't know the details. I think we have the same gut instinct. What are you guys teaching in schools about how to do references properly?
Yeah, especially by the time you're in high school, you really ought to know that.
You really should know how to do references by that. I mean, in middle school at St. Anne's, we were already kind of doing references anyways. I mean, it wasn't like a term research paper for a PhD, but we were taught how to use an encyclopedia.
That's correct. Yes, I still know how to use a card catalog if we can find one.
You're absolutely correct. So,
Hey, let's talk about a fun event that happened in Quincy today.
yeah, we were with the Speaker of the House and Mayor Koch and various school committee and counselors regarding the United States of Readers, which, again, if you're on YouTube or TV, it's inverted, which promotes reading around the country. And the legislature provided some funding for this. And we give two books, or they're going to give two books, not us, but give two books to each student. And they're going to build their own little library of books. It is encouraging reading grades 4 through 6. And the Clifford Marshall School in Quincy is the first recipient of the United States of Readers. And Speaker, of course, district is in Clifford Marshall School. And we actually had the pleasure of Jerry, let's see if we can enunciate, Jerry Paolotta, and illustrated by Robert Bolster on who would win lobster versus crab, which is actually, looking through this book, is incredibly educational, to be honest with you, regarding lobsters and crabs and the differences of which, and letting students judge themselves who is the better crustacean for comparison purposes. And Jerry here wrote a series of books similarly on who would win,
That's neat. That's neat.
a
He's
whole bunch
from
of them.
Scituate, actually, so that's very appropriate that it's a coastal theme.
He is, and I stuck around for his presentation a little bit afterwards, and he's really wonderful, actually, on presenting to children. Wonderful. And you learn a lot. I was learning a lot, sitting the way he was able to communicate and educate the kids, in this case, about lobsters and crabs.
Yeah, that's neat because an author and an educator, two different talents. So good for him. Yeah.
Well, I get picked on every so often by my relatives about the fact that I do like pictures and books to go together. But it does matter. I mean, the visualization does help a lot.
Some people are just visual learners, so it's helpful for them. Yeah.
It is. And, as I said at the press conference, reading is a gateway to the imagination. It allows you to want to think outside the box and develop your own ideas and imaginations, which, frankly, things like TikTok doesn't. It's feeding you stuff, it's not stimulating. You're mimicking. People on social media influencers essentially mimickers.
Yeah, no, it's nice to see there's still a place for books and reading in this world.
Yeah, this helps grow an idea.
Right.
And I think that's very important. I'd mentioned that, I obviously grew up in a different time in Quincy, and most people don't realize that I did not grow up in an English-speaking household as a young child before school. I was actually a Cantonese-speaking household. And there's this whole shock of needing to learn English before we had ESL programs or bilingual education programs in school systems. So reading was a crucial part of my education as a very young child, and books with pictures were very helpful
Sure.
reading. And the as well as I read, I was like, well, Clifford the Big Red Dog was a very common book when I was in kindergarten.
Sure.
I still have my Sleepy Little Lion book, which I got when they closed the school, sadly, at Beechwood Knoll. It was a one book that I really enjoyed for some reason when I was in first
You
grade.
see, those are formative years. You still remember them. So that just goes to show you the power of that.
Yeah, and folks knows me well. I'm a big comic book reader. Again, visual learner. And comic books aren't just for kids anymore, folks. They're very much very
Oh,
adult.
it's big business now. Yes, that's for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, the writing is much more sophisticated, much more about more adult conversations, really teen and above conversations. It's more
Yeah.
than just for people perceive as kind of the funny pages in the back of the newspapers. It's
Yeah.
much more than that. Again, we all congratulations and our ability to relax and read.
Question three, unionized app-based workers.
Oh, we took a break just to get back to the questions.
You think I was going to let you off the hook?
This one is literally what it sounds like. It's about whether or not to allow collective bargaining for rideshare workers such as Uber and Lyft. Right, Uber and Lyft are kind of a very unique economic model, a very unique employment model where everyone's a contractor for those companies. You get to pick your hours, you get to pick go work, but you have your own vehicles. You actually are a 1099 contractor, and but you can take expenses off your taxes as a self-employed individual. However, unlike other jobs, your entire ability to maintain your job is 100% dependent on your riders giving you a rating, which is part of the contract. You fall below a customer rating, you will lose your ability to work for that rideship. And it becomes a question of whether or not the situation is an actual contractor or not, because it's such a unique situation. Because if you think about other types of contractors, you and I can contract each other to do a job, but you as a contractee can go anywhere else and do the same job for someone else,
Right.
including potential
You can
competitors.
essentially moonlight, is what they used to call it.
Yeah, you basically can build a portfolio of customers and do what you need to do to fulfill those contracts. In the case of Uber Lyft, the competitors, I can be both Uber and Lyft driver, competitor. So the question is, do you allow unionization on something where you're not an exclusive employee?
Right. And then if you work for both, which union do you belong to? Both?
Well, you also can do this, for example, it could be a side delivery service. You could deliver
Yes.
pizza too. You could work for a delivery package. You can work for a livery service. You could do a number of different things in addition to Uber and Lyft. You're absolutely correct. It is a bit of a confusing thing because unlike other type of contract jobs, it's not about exclusivity. It's about the fact that you have a lot more flexibility, but your contingency of continued employment is not dependent on the contractor. It's
Right.
dependent on customer.
Yes.
I could fire you if you're my contractor, contractee, whatever, because you did a crap job. And I'm like, I'm not paying you because you did a crap job. I'm going to fight
Right.
in court, or we have to do some arbitration and mitigate the fact that you're not delivering on the end of the contract. Or I'll go to the contract and then proceed to do the remediation via the contract. That doesn't really exist in rideshare.
I see. Yeah.
And it's a very complicated question because we're trying to compare it to a 9-to-5 employer-employee relationship or apply it to a conventional understanding of contractors. It doesn't, either example does not apply in rideshare. Completely unique employment model, including complete unique termination. Termination is completely dependent on consumer rating, not on the contractor's determination of the individual's employment
Right.
performance.
Yeah, there's no review, employee review. Yeah.
Yeah, I expect you to deliver me an apple. I
Right.
contract you for X dollars. You get me the apple. I did not dictate how the apple would look, so you just picked the apple. But if I said the apple had to be a red color and that's pristine with a perfect glow, then you give me like a green apple that's destroyed, your contract is not fulfilled.
Right.
Then I'm not going to pay you.
Right. Right.
Right? It's not like you delivered the apple to me, but you aren't the one, I'm not paying you directly. I'm paying you via my mom. I'm paying my mom to hire you, but she's the contract of you, not me. Say, and it becomes this whole real convoluted
Yeah,
problem.
and this would be the first in the nation if it does pass.
Yes, California tried this, really was very expansive, was going to have an adverse effect on gig workers, basically the acting and musician industry, photographers. So that got killed off in California. People blamed the big ride shares, which is okay, fair, but that was also very expansive. This one's much more narrow.
Yeah.
And also want to remind folks that, the rideshare companies have negotiated a settlement with the AG to provide a same minimum wage, which I believe is $35 an hour.
I think it's 32.50.
32.50. So yeah, so the AG had negotiated minimum wage with 30 32.50.
Which
So
is, a very respectable starting minimum wage.
yeah,
Yeah.
that's what, like 65-ish thousand dollars a year.
Not a bad way to start, yeah.
Yeah, assuming a 40-hour work week
Right.
scenario. Obviously there's no overtime, so it could be substantially more. So yeah, so again, it's a little bit confusing. Not sure how it would unroll if it did go forward. Yeah.
Question four, legalizing psychedelics.
Still don't understand it. Can't explain it. Psychedelics have been now used more and more in terms of mental health assistance as an alternative medication. Research is still very early on it. not clear how we regulate a new drug that has not been really known to use, what dosage makes sense. I don't know how this would work.
It is very confusing. It's a very voluminous question if you read it through in that booklet. But I did read a section that it would allow folks to grow this stuff like they can do marijuana now, and you know, that's a little disturbing.
Well, marijuana, we all know, makes you sleepy and hungry for the most part. Bad marijuana probably won't kill you before at home. Grow the wrong mushroom, you could be dead.
Yeah, this is powerful stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, and you got to know what mushrooms are, right? I mean, mushroom picking, even for psychedelics, I mean, you have to know how to pick a mushroom.
Right.
And you got spores. And it's not everyone has a good time with mushroom spores. Like, remember, actually during COVID, we had the bad rainy season. My entire lawn was littered with mushrooms. And we're not talking about psychedelic mushrooms, just mushrooms in general, folks. Oh my God, the respiratory problems I was having when I went to my yard.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
Because once they all sprouted, it's just spores everywhere.
Yeah.
So I know it's a sidetrack, people, I know. But, you know, what I'm getting at is that you actually know what you're doing.
Yeah. And there's, like you say, there's still so much research that needs to be done. There's so many questions that need to be answered, even on the part of people, you know, doctors who do use these.
Yeah, again, I'm think the research is real. I think it'll be a great medical provider. I just don't understand how the medicine would work.
Right. And then the proverbial question five, which is getting a lot of attention also, is minimum wage for tip workers.
Yeah, you've seen the increasing number of commercials by the Mass Restaurant Association. Question five to fight it. You've seen it a lot on mobile social media. I've actually talked to Restaurant Association folks, and you know, they're working very hard on this one. Another one, I'm not sure how it would play out. I'm not sure what the information is on how to do this. We are one of the few countries in the world that tips. Most countries are eliminating tipping or have eliminated tipping. They provide service charges, they provide other things in the bottom of it, or they just increase prices, which people just accept as part of competing for best workers, right? Tipping, depending on what restaurant you're in, because it's a percentage of total bill. Again, we can debate about how you tip, which was a whole different conversation, can be very substantial. You can make a lot of money, you know, on a Saturday night in a nice restaurant, right?
Right.
And the way it works now is that there's a minimum wage amount, which is substantially lower than 5%. I think it's like
6.75 an hour.
75 an hour, and this would move them up to the $15 minimum wage. Knowing what happened is that your tips do not equal the number, if the difference between the 6.75 and the tips don't equal 15, the restaurant has to make up the difference.
Correct.
So what does this mean? I don't know, because it's really complicated, right? We have a service industry that's completely dependent on tips. We have a restaurant industry who does not pay conventional salary or hourly wages because of tips. By the way, if you're curious, tips came out of the prohibition.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was because prohibition killed a lot of bars and restaurants because, you know, prohibition.
It's because they couldn't sell anything, right? Yeah.
So the choices was to jack up restaurant prices or create tipping.
Oh, okay, interesting.
So they basically stopped paying restaurant servers and forced a culture of tipping, which is
Yeah.
where it came from.
Ah, so this goes back to what, the 20s?
Yeah, this goes back to prohibition. Yeah, so does income taxes because
Yeah, I know all about that when I'm talking about that.
government made a lot of money on sin taxes. When we take the sin tax away, we create income taxes. So
Like gambling today.
that's correct. That is correct. It's not a bad analogy. So I suppose the question is this, right? If you vote in favor of minimum wage, will restaurant prices go up? Will you tip less? Will tipping be something of the past? Will you hurt a restaurant worker who could have made more money on tips to minimum wage, depending where they were? And I know tip culture is hurting all of us. I mean, we're young enough to remember 10% was the standard, and now we're in 25% zone as the standard, right? And now you have social media out there that actually blasts past, your bad tipper, you get called out, right? It's
Right.
a totally different time period. But at the same time, though, as the customer, why am I paying your employees?
Yeah, it comes down to a matter of who pays, essentially. Does the customer pay the difference, or does the restaurant pay the difference? Yeah.
The restaurant's going to pass the cost to you anyway
Right.
in the food bill. And so this is really kind of you as a voter kind of have to think about from the point of view of an industry that frankly we don't participate in the sense we don't run a restaurant business.
Right.
We were most of us are not likely to have been serving food to people. We're the consumer on this situation. And if you're not part of the industry, the consumer, which is the voter, which is going to be most of us are consumers as a voter, is going to have to make a determination on someone else's salary and someone else's business model.
That's right. Essentially, that's what it comes down to. Yeah.
And that's what this is in the bottom line. And that's why it's a hard one to advise people because it's like, how much do you really know about this industry, right? I
Right.
mean, servers will tell you different stories depending where they work,
Well,
right?
that's right. And that's based on their experience. Yeah.
Yeah, and restaurateurs will give you different opinions based on the different service industries they provide.
Yeah.
Not all restaurant industries are identical, and not all restaurant industries are purely tip-based. For example, baristas are not tip-based. Those are paid by minimum wage.
Right.
And there's a weird part in this thing about pooling tips, which is illegal. The tips you earn is the tips that belong to you. Restaurants should not pool tips. But also be aware that if it's a mandatory gratuity, that is a taxable thing against the restaurant. It guarantees that the server gets the gratuity from you because the restaurant's demanded it.
Right.
They don't have to have minimum six or minimum eight. They could do it just straight up. And I've complained about this before. I was in Somerville and the restaurant created a kitchen charge. And you all know the restaurant industry is upset with credit card fees and they want to pass those costs to you, which the state prohibits, which I believe is actually unconstitutional. However,
Oh, interesting.
that's a longer conversation about that.
Yeah, we have to talk about that at another time. Yeah.
That's a different conversation, which I believe, based on what I'm reading, is unconstitutional. But consumers, you as a consumer, kind of in a weird spot.
Yeah.
You really want to think this through. You're kind of in a weird spot.
It'll be interesting for sure. So, we're not here to say yay or nay, just to kind of present both sides and let folks make their own minds. Because
Yeah.
early voting starts Saturday.
Quincy starts their early in-person voting starts in
Right.
person. But you can tell there's a couple of questions here that kind of weird spot regarding you deciding what happens in employee-employee relationships, which is the ride shift. I'm sorry, the ride lit ride share Lyft and Uber, and now this tipping question.
Yeah.
Have an entirely medical related question, which has a lot of fine print in the bill, which is number four on the mushrooms, psychedelics. And then number two is seems to be somewhat of a generational question of us as individuals trying to decide what is the standard of education. Well, most of us have not been in the classroom. Most of us, actually, that's not true. A lot of us have probably taken the MCAS at this point. So a lot of us have done the MCAS. Many of us have not been in the current high school environment for schooling. And whether or not, frankly, you and I could ever have passed the MCAS today.
Yeah. I'm glad I don't have to take it. Let's put it that way.
Both.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have graduated high school. I mean, I was
And then of
national.
course there's the state auditor's question number one. But we're
Yeah,
not gonna
that's,
talk about that.
you don't have to talk about that. It's pretty self-evident. And as I've spoken before in the past, we're the legislative branch. We tell the executive branch what to do. It's not the other way around.
We'll leave it at that.
Constitution puts the power in the people, not in the power of the people is in the legislature, not the executive branch.
How do folks get a hold of you, the people, Tacky?
617-722-2370. We are staffed. We are in the office in room 42 of the State House. It will be my office until this calendar session ends. If you get the speaker on the line at some point, you're welcome to ask him what committee I'm getting next year. but at least for this remaining year, I know what office I'm in. Tacky.chan, TACKEY.CHAN at mahouse.gov, tacky.chan at mahouse.gov. Welcome your emails. I do read all my emails. I do sort by constituent service emails first. I do read all your different policy emails. I can't promise I remember all your names because there's so many of them. But we do sift through these things, and I do read them. We got at Tacky Chan on X. We have State Representative Tacky Chan on Facebook, which hopefully we'll have some good pictures of the United States of Readers on today at some point. We do have the malegislature.gov. Malegislature.gov is your legislative website page. And you don't actually need me to look up bills because, as I say over and over again, the website lets you do it yourself. Tackychan.org is our reference page. I do actually get emails through there. There's a contact sheet there you can reach out through. And of course, you have you and me, hopefully weekly or bi-weekly basis. And you can check with Joe every morning for his 10-minute Quincy update.
Awesome. Welcome back, Tacky. It's so good to have you back.
It is good. And as we close in on election season, we're going to talk more about how this is going to play out. And hopefully, I'll be down on election night at QA TV to provide some commentary.
Yeah, we'd love to have you. We're providing live coverage Tuesday night, November 5th. So tune in.
Yep. And everyone, remember, please go vote. Early voting's out. Quincy Sen tells me 14,000 ballots or mail-in ballots have already gone out.
I talked to Nicole, the city clerk, yesterday. Now it's over 15,000.
It's going to be a big turnout this year.
Yeah, she's thinking about 80%.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you have to ask what the record, I think it was the Kennedy election year. The president
Yeah.
was a statistic highest turnout in
I'll have to
Quincy.
ask Joe Shea about that. He would know.
I think that was a percentage was the highest turnout. So get out and vote. Get your absentee ballot if you're out of state. If you got a student that's out of state, make sure to get their absentee ballot out. But there's no shortage of ways to do it. And of course, the entire legislative delegation very much encourages you to get out and get your voice out.
We will talk soon, Tacky.
We will. I'll see you then, Joe.